Hey there, conductors. If you've ever felt that you're not quite sure what to do next when you're studying a score, maybe you don't even know where to start with a difficult piece, maybe you study one piece too much and then you realize at the first rehearsal that you don't know another one well enough, or maybe you're a new conductor and you don't know what score study is, I'm excited to share that I'm finally publishing and sharing my score study checklist. I've been refining this for 12 years now, and I'm so excited to share it. It is going to walk you through my structure, my process to make sure that I learn every score that I need to learn well enough and so that nothing falls through the cracks. So it covers everything that you need to know. There's a link in the show notes. Go ahead and click it, sign up, and you'll get that score study checklist sent right to your email. You'll also get access to an 8-minute video of me explaining what each section is and how I use it to organize all the music that I need to learn. It's only 8 minutes, so it's not going to take you a whole hour to learn how to study better, how to put up a process for your score study, and how to make sure that nothing is falling through the cracks. So again, click the link in the show notes, and I hope to see you soon. Now, please enjoy this episode of Podium Time. Welcome to Podium Time, the podcast for conductors and students.
And that was enough to get people in. It was on a Sunday, so people are looking for something to do. And I think, like I said, I was skeptical. I did not think it was going to work, but I just said, well, let's go in and let's just do it. Let's see what happens. I think the reason that it worked is the emphasis was on the experience, not on us telling people how they should feel and when to show up.
Yeah, today we're talking with Emilio Guarino. Is that how you say your name?
You got it.
All right, perfect. And so I met you at Bard. We just kind of chatted one day, and I think, did I ask you about your end pin? Is that how I started the conversation? Maybe you don't remember. I don't remember either.
Maybe, yeah, I think Endpin, yeah, I think you might have, because at that point I was playing on a prototype of it, and it looked kind of weird, so.
Yeah, and this is a product that you've invented from the ground up and gotten to production and everything, right?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's, yeah, basically the elevator version of it is, it's a base Endpin that's angled, that you can put into the bass, and it changes the way the instrument balances to make it a little bit more ergonomic to play. Mm-hmm. And the big differentiating thing about my version of it is it's easier to adjust than the traditional way they would normally implement this, and it doesn't require you to modify the instrument. You can just buy it as a kit, put it in the bass, and you're ready to go. Mm-hmm.
So what kind of brought this around? Like, what made you create this? Was there like a gig that you just got tired of dealing with your M-Pin? You were like, this is it. I've had it. I'm going to do my own thing now.
Kind of the thing that sort of kicked it off was when I was getting out of grad school, I had a hand injury. I was getting like pain in my wrist and stuff, you know, like all the horrible performance injuries you hear about. I had one, and so that sort of sent me down this quest to clean up my playing and just be more relaxed and figure out what was causing the problem. So one of the things was the way my instrument was set up wasn't ideal for a bunch of reasons. So I went and did that, and then I started getting into these angled end pins because I had heard that, oh, this is a popular thing, and a lot of people like it because it makes the bass a little bit more comfortable. And I generally like them, but then I didn't find the provided options that great. Like what a lot of people would do is they drill into the bass and they change the setup. So I was like, I'm not so nuts about drilling into my bass. And then the adjustable, like sort of off the shelf kind of options like there was one product specifically that I wanted and they didn't make anymore. So, I started talking to some people and I said, hey, this is kind of what I would want. And could you make this? So long story short, I was able to find some help making a simple prototype and then eventually was able to get it into production and start selling them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a, that whole process we may dive into later. I know you have the sticker example in your book, but yep. So we met, briefly at Bard because of the end pin. And then I think about 6 months later, I listened to an interview on Andrew Hitt's podcast, mm-hmm. The Entrepreneurial Musician. And I didn't connect that it was with you. I just connected that it was with someone else named Emilio. And then,
yeah.
And so I went and I bought the book that you guys talked about. And then just before I reached out to you a couple months ago, I saw your story on Facebook Messenger, I think. And it was you holding up the book. And I was like, oh, all right then.
That guy.
I didn't even realize.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so your book is Make It, A Guide for Recent Music Graduates. And mm-hmm. and we'll link to some of the other discussions that you've had because I think they're very good. I wanted to talk a bit about some of the big changes that you talk about between being in school and being out of school. You know, you talk sure. about the real world in your book, and I think that's big. And there are a lot of things you pointed out in this that I had never thought about. And the reason cool. we wanted to talk about this now is because Luke and I at least are just about to graduate and get into that spot. And I'm sure plenty other listeners are also because it's that time of the year. So could you talk a little bit about just briefly the how you would describe the book? Because I can go about it, but I'd like to hear how you would describe it, maybe for conductors in particular, if that's possible.
Well, I'm not a conductor, but I'll try. Let me just go with the reason why I wrote the book.
Okay. Right.
I wrote it, I'm 30 now. It came out like 2 years ago. So I would have been 28 when it came out. I didn't turn 28, you know, at that point I had been out of music school for like maybe 2 or 3 years, right? I didn't have the gumption to go around saying like, oh, I know what I'm doing. I'm the authority on this now. I need to, you know, to tell you what to do. That's not where it came from at all. Basically what happened was I finished school, went through the same little freak out that a lot of people go through where they're not really sure what to do and how do I find work and blah, blah, blah. And I just did what I had to do. I as best I knew at the time anyway, and got going and like things were going okay. I was making, you know, not like a crazy living, but, making a living, just doing it. And when I would go and play at schools or teach lessons to people or even just chat with other people on like an informal sort of basis, people started asking me like, how are you getting this together? How did you do that? People just started asking for information that I thought was obvious. That's really the genesis of the thing. So then I started saying, well, maybe I should just put this out there and see what people do with it. Because also the barriers to entry as far as writing a book are pretty low now. Like I didn't have to go and find a publisher and sell them on the idea. I could just kind of go do it. So that's what I did. At the time, I was flying like a lot. So I had all this time to kill just when I was on airplanes and stuff. So that I used that time, like if I had a 10-hour flight, I was like, instead, I want to write down all this stuff that I'm thinking about that people might be interested in. So that's what I did. It's an attempt basically to scale up some of the things that I was telling students and that kind of and friends and all that when they would ask, like, just how to do stuff. I wanted to get that all down. And I also started thinking that it was important to get it down while I was kind of fresh out of school.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things I noticed was in music school, I was getting advice from people who were like, in terms of their career, they were like 40 years ahead of me, right? Which is awesome. You need those kinds of figures in your life for sure. But I started to think that, well, okay, when these people were in my shoes, the sort of climate of the music community and industry was very different. 40 years ago was, you know, the way you put it together just isn't, it's similar in some ways, but also different in others. So anyway, I started thinking, I know personally, I wanted to have some kind of mentorship from people who were way ahead of me. So you need that sagacious Yoda character in your life that is 40 years ahead of you, right? But then you need some people who are maybe half that distance ahead of you. And then you need some other people who are maybe 5 or 10 years ahead of you, because the conditions that they got started in are going to be more similar to where you are, or where I was at that point, or even where I still am. I'm not that old. So
that's the idea
is like, what's that?
I was going to say, some of the issues that they're facing now are going to be pretty similar to the ones that we are.
Yeah, exactly. And I have a couple people in my life who were that mentor that was maybe like 7 or 8 years ahead of me in terms of their career. And they were able to give me some good advice. So anyway, I was just thinking like, okay, I'm 28. What would I tell myself when I was 19 or 20, you know, when I was first coming out of school? Specifically as an undergraduate. So that's most of the stuff that I decided to get into the book.
So the biggest thing that I really like about this book is, of course, it's a lot of really good information, but it's really focused on specifically what some of the problems that musicians may face. And the biggest topic that you cover that you mention in a couple different chapters is you talk about the real world and how it kind of starts, but the difference that I'm personally a little bit worried about is the accountability is the word that I'm looking for, because in school you talk about you have your teachers. If you mess something up or if you're falling behind, you have your teachers, you have your peers. But then once you're not in that environment anymore, now if you mess up, they just don't invite you back.
Yeah, that's a common one.
Mm-hmm.
The accountability thing, there's a bunch of things to unpack, I guess. So one thing is that I don't like to think of the real world being like, you know, everything else outside of school. And then school is this little walled garden where you're safe and happy and nothing. Like, I think that you need to totally throw that out the window. I think that everything is the real world. When you're in school, that's part of the real world. You can decide to acknowledge that or not, but I think that's what it is. And I haven't really heard a compelling argument to the contrary. So if that sounds a little blunt, well, you know, convince me otherwise. I just haven't been able to have somebody sell me on that yet. So you're in this little part of the real world, and I think it's fine that school sort of judges you and rates your performance on the system that it does. I think that's really okay, as long as you realize that that's not how you'll be judged in a lot of working environments, mm-hmm. especially as a freelance musician. there's a lot of things that go into it. And like just for example, I took a lot of classes in college where I was graded based on improvement and effort, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So like I took a jazz improv class that was, I think it was either 2 semesters or 2 years. I can't remember which. It might've been 2 semesters. So I'm taking jazz improv. And at the time I was like, I was really bad. I was still getting a lot of things together as far as technically being able to play the instrument. And I got good grades in the class because it wasn't an absolute scale. You know, it was, they wanted to see that I was practicing every week and they wanted to see that I was improving. But it's, if you're on a gig, nobody cares about your improvement. They care, yeah. Like, can you do this right now? Yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you just, when you're in school, you'll get a lot more out of it and you'll be better prepared for postgraduate life if you know that going in. So that's one example of the kind of thing I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I really liked about the book is all the, your actionable steps at the end of each chapter. Mm-hmm. And when I went through it a couple months ago, I took out my journal and I sat yep. down and I answered every question, and it was a really good exercise, and it revealed a lot of things to me, especially in the first couple mindset chapters, which I know for sure I'll be returning to, mm-hmm. maybe every couple months, because there's a lot of, good stuff in there. And, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, the habit stacking that you talk about.
Yeah, I think, I'm a big believer that the human body is kind of a habit machine, right? I think I read somewhere, what was it, that you're I might be wrong in this, but it's something like your whole brain, your whole body, everything you do is, it runs off of, like, I think it's 100 watts of electricity or something. It might be even lower.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sitting there, I was like, wait a minute. Everything that I do, like the whole, my whole day is, you know, like a light bulb. What? And the reason I bring that up is your body is, and your mind are incredibly efficient at performing certain tasks. And the way, or one of the ways that your body achieves this efficiency is through automating certain things, through habit. And if you don't implement healthy habits that help you get to where you want to be, your body is going to put habits in place for you, whether you like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's the major point I wanted to make in that section. So if you just, and also because we live in modern times with like infinite distractions and, you know, and like cheap donuts at every corner, you know, and YouTube and Facebook and all these things where you can easily get yourself into kind of a mess if you just go completely by your instincts and urges. So I think that by stacking healthy habits that help you achieve what you want, you don't really have an option as to whether you need to do that, because if you don't do that, you're going to pick up bad habits that take you away from where you want to go. And basically a lot of it is just like, it comes down to building discipline, right? And musicians tend to be pretty disciplined already. Like if you can get good at an instrument, that means you already have to sit down and like go through the thing where you're like, I'm going to practice this for this long and I need to fix this in my playing. So you already have a framework for how to do it. I just think you need to take that and apply it to other things right now. Mm-hmm. What other things do you need to apply that to? That's what some of the exercises in the book are supposed to help you pick apart, right? Because if you want to get to some kind of goal or you want to have some kind of thing happen for yourself, you need to first, you need to visualize it and do the more creative part where you're like, how might we do this and what might that look like? But then if you want it to happen, you need to break it apart into manageable chunks that are actionable, right? That's what's called actionable steps. So it's like, how do you take some lofty goal you have and break it into little things that are tasks that you have to get yourself to do? How do you develop a plan to execute for yourself that lets you get towards your goal? And again, in the book, there's a bunch of examples of stuff. I know I gave in one of the chapters, you mentioned the sticker example. Mm-hmm. Where it's like if you're looking to make some extra money, you want to learn how to sell things, how to be an entrepreneur, that kind of thing. That's probably the simplest example I could think of how to think of an idea and then put it into production, right? Like getting stickers made is not that hard, but if you've never done it before, that's something that's going to teach you a lot about how to break that process down. And then when you want to go for something a little bit more ambitious, you already have a small base to start off of. So like for example, like this whole, the book in my world was kind of my version of a sticker project, right? It was, mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to write a book. How does this look like? How do we pull this into little steps? So like the first step was to start writing every day, or whenever I had any time to fit some writing in. And that's one of those things where you just have to be disciplined and tell yourself you're going to do it. And some days are better than others. Some days you sit down and write and it's not great, and you go back and delete everything later, but that's okay. It's more important that you just sit down and make doing it a habit, at least for a little while. And then mm-hmm. eventually I had enough material together where I said, okay, I think it's maybe time to send this out to an editor and start talking about finalizing the format. And then while that's happening, I had a list of other things that had to happen. Making the cover. Books have a cover. How do you do that? Books have a barcode. How do you get a barcode on something? How does that work? So it's just kind of going down the list of things that I need to happen. Things that I think need to happen. And then along the way, I was checking in with other people and sort of showing them where I was at and saying, what do you think? I did the cover of the book myself. I got busy in Photoshop and made it happen. Right. But I'm also like terrible at Photoshop. I didn't draw the little graphic. I got that from somebody. Mm-hmm. But then as far as actually laying it out and doing the layout of the cover and getting it to the right size, that I did myself. The first couple drafts were horrible. they were genuinely very ugly.
Yeah.
So that was one of those things where I showed a couple people who were better at this than me and just said, what do you think? And they steered me in a more sensible direction. So, mm-hmm. That's just one example of many potential ones.
Yeah. And so the book's been out for a bit, and I imagine that you're still playing gigs, and I imagine there are a couple people that you would feel like you just want to hand it to them and tell them, okay, read this and then come back. What are some of the things that you see gigging, some of the most prevalent problems?
Problems as far as people doing things not well, or
things that you not with you specifically, things that you maybe see in other people.
Well, I don't want to be too hard on people. No, but I think let me think of some common ones that come up a lot. First of all, I think before I start, start talking about that, one of the things that I see in myself that I think is normal and healthy is I look back on how I was doing things. Like I'm 30 now, when I look at how I was doing some things or how I was thinking about certain things when I was 24 or 25 or sometimes I'll look at an old email from like 2008 and it's like immediate facepalm and I'm like, oh my God, what was I thinking? Like, mm-hmm. But I think that's totally normal and healthy, because that means that I've grown and moved on from where I was at that time. I can see the mistakes now really clearly, and I can say, oh, okay, this is what I was doing wrong because I was thinking this and not that. So I think that's the first thing is if you're really dedicated to improving and growing as a person, not just necessarily having your career grow, but as a human, you're going to go back and look at what you were doing and then just be like, oh God, it's exactly like, it's like listening to a video of yourself practicing from like 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Like you ever find one of those on your computer and you're just like, what was I doing? Dear God. I think that if you want to really grow, like I said, and work on some of this stuff, that's going to happen with all kinds of things. And that happens to me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it happens with all kinds of stuff. Like sometimes I'll be fully honest, I go on my website that's up right now and I'm just like, what are we going to do, guys? We got to get this together. You know, cause I know more about it now. And that's not bad. It just means you're getting better at stuff. So mm-hmm. you need to go back and you make a little sticky note with the problem. You put that on your wall, you fix it, and then make more sticky notes and then keep doing that over and over again.
Yeah.
But anyway, as far as mistakes that I see a lot of the time, especially ones from people coming straight out of school, I'll get a message from somebody who's basically just like just begging for work, begging for gigs.
Oh, yeah.
Say, and there's better ways to do that than others. And I get why they're doing it. They're like, oh, I want to play more. I want money, all these things. Sending me or sending anybody an email or a Facebook message or even a phone call where your pitch is, hey, I really need work right now and you should give it to me.
Yeah.
That's not what you want to do. And I see different versions of that happen a lot where it's like, hey, come listen to my band because we're awesome and you should listen to us. Like, in general, it works a lot better if you think about, hey, how can I help serve other people? Because mm-hmm. if I help them get what they want, then that will help me get what I want. That's how you should approach it. Think about, hey, how do I help somebody? That's a lot more attractive of a sell than saying, hey, give me work. So for example, if you're I'm trying to think how this would apply to a conductor, but as a player, the way to do it is if somebody comes up to me and says, like, I just had a guy do this in the last couple months. Nice dude, great bass player. And he just said, hey, I'm in the area. Here's some videos and links to my playing so you can hear what I do. If you're ever looking for a sub sometime, I'd be interested. I'd appreciate it if you could keep me in mind. And that was it. Mm-hmm. And he turned out to be a pretty solid dude. He shows up on time. He wears the right suit, all that kind of stuff. He sounds good. But again, he came at it from the angle of, hey, whenever you need somebody, I would mm-hmm. be happy to help. That, again, I'm like, if I get a cold email from somebody or a cold phone call, I'm still going to be a little skeptical because I'm like, I don't know this person. What, you know, are they going to say something weird on a gig that reflects back on me? You know, so it's not like an instant, you know, slam dunk. But just the fact that he knew to approach it from that angle of, hey, I want to help you out and I'm happy to do it whenever there's a need. That says a lot about how they're thinking about things.
Yeah.
So that's probably one of the biggest ones. Or like another one that I see pop up. This might apply to conductors more if you're putting a concert together and promoting it and trying to get people to come out.
Mm-hmm.
I see a lot of of people saying, hey, Beethoven is happening and you have to listen to it. So it's like some version of that. Like it's saying, hey, we're doing this music and if you don't like it, then you're unsophisticated and simple. You know? So, I don't think that's a great way to convince people to come to a concert.
Yeah.
So I think what's a better way is you need to sell them a little bit on, again, like why they should come, why they're going to have a great time, why they're going to get something out of it. Not like, hey, come listen to my thing because you should like it. It's a simple thing, but I see it over and over and over again. Or on the same note, people I call it like shouting into the void, like, or yelling into the well, where people they go and they put their stuff up online on Facebook or something where that you can invite 500 people at a clip, mm-hmm. and they're just kind of they're not really making an effort to connect with individual people, which is really what you're trying to do. Because when you put your concert poster up or whatever, what at the end of the day, it's you're trying to have some person on the other end sit there on their phone or on their computer or wherever and feel connected enough to it that they say, hey, I'm going to block out my Saturday or my Sunday afternoon. I want to go see this. This needs to happen.
Yeah. And maybe spend some money, have to travel for it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, how are you going to get somebody to be excited enough to be like, whoa, it's only $10. Like, where's my credit card? Let's go do this. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So yelling into the well isn't going to do that. Just being like, this Mendelssohn is happening on Sunday. Here, come. Like, mm-hmm. that's not enough. Why do they need to come? Why should they be excited about it? A lot of people, like the people who that might work on, like if I see a cool group doing a piece that I like, then that might be enough to say, like, oh, hey, you know, Rite of Spring's happening. It's where? It's this much? Yeah, let me do it. I love that piece. That might be enough, maybe.
Yeah,
but I'm a musician. I know what the Rite of Spring is. When you say, "Hey, we're doing a Stravinsky concert," I like Stravinsky, so I'm going to get excited about it. And those people, you know, you can be a little bit more informational and just say, like, "This is happening here," and they know they're already sold on coming to a Stravinsky concert. They just need the details as to how to get there. But especially for classical musicians, especially what we should be working on is pulling new people in to our little world, because it's not a huge world as far as listenership, right? Like, I think, like, if you go online, you can find all kinds of depressing statistics about how, like, you know, 0.5% or 1% of the whole U.S. population would even consider buying a ticket to a concert of orchestral music.
Mm-hmm.
Some people look at that as like, oh, boo-hoo, you know, we're screwed, all this stuff. I'm like, well, actually what that means is we just need to find a better way to get people in. Because personally, I don't think the problem is I don't think the problem is the music. I think the music is great.
Mm-hmm.
I show a lot of music to people who are not in this world, like in the way that we are. I think if you present it in a more digestible way for somebody who's coming to it as a newcomer, they're pretty open to it and they're interested. I think more often than not, they might just be intimidated. So it's almost like I don't know if you guys are religious or anything, but I remember, like, I grew up going to like Protestant churches and stuff. And I remember the first time I went to a Catholic church, I felt completely lost because there's like a process and there's like things you have to say and there's a secret handshake and there's like all these moves. So I felt like I went into somebody else's secret club and I just had no idea what to do because everybody else was they all these things, and they just like they knew when to do it, and I did because they were more familiar with the ritual of it.
Yeah.
A lot of classical music concerts feel like that to other people, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
Where like how many times we've all seen it happen where there's the one or two people who start clapping between movements, and then they get shushed by all the people around them, and then they walk out thinking like, "What did I do? I clapped after the end, and it was awesome. Why was everybody mad at me?" Right?
Yeah. How dare you enjoy the music?
Yeah, but you just I think they walk out really confused. Like, what went wrong? I don't know. And then somebody maybe says to them like, "Oh, it's between movements," and they're like, "Well, what's a movement? I don't know." Like,
yeah.
So, with that in mind, I think what we should be doing in classical music is I hate to even say classical, but orchestral music, concert music.
Mm-hmm.
If you're interested in promoting events with that kind of performance, I think it's really important to just think again about how are we serving the other people? How do we get new people excited about this rather than how do we market to the old guard who already is familiar with how all this stuff works?
Yeah. Well, and I think that when we are, if we're thinking about it like that, just saying, "Oh, here's Mendelssohn, come see it."
Yeah.
And maybe even with the Stravinsky, the audience that we're considering is like our peers and other musicians.
Yeah.
Which is a very limited audience with limited time.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't think personally that the audience has to be limited. I think it can grow, but that getting it to grow takes a lot of work.
Yeah, and that's one of the challenges.
Mm-hmm.
You know, any conductor that's programming or starting an orchestra, the difficulty is competing with what else is around, but also saying, okay, here's what we're going to offer. But a lot of people, I think don't even consider what they're going to offer, and they think that, you know, maybe just the music is enough to offer, but even if that is enough, you still have to convince people to spend the money and spend the time and spend the effort to come to your concert.
Yeah, and also I think it's important to consider how they're going to interact with each other.
Because
music at the end of the day, like I think the reason that it exists and the reason that it's part of humanity, because it's an ancient thing, is pretty much any kind of concert situation, it's a communal thing.
Yeah.
So I think part of the fun for me, and I think a lot of other people, part of the fun of going to concerts is going and knowing that you're with your people, so to speak, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're with this group of people that shares some similar values and you get to interact with them. It's not all about the audience member and the group. You're kind of just the group is sort of like the what's the word I'm looking for? You know, you're kind of the shaman that leads the whole ceremony, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You're as a group, you're the spiritual leader of the event, right? But
mm-hmm.
the event is about everybody because you're all in a room together. I've made some friends and just had a lot of good times, like just going to concerts, seeing something happen, and then hanging out with people after. I think that's a super important part of the experience.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, you go, you see something happen, and then you get in your car and you leave. Like that's not what it's about. It's about being with people and having a shared experience with them, and then getting to use that to relate to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like just again, it's like that's why when you go to a concert, like I go to concerts alone all the time because I just want to see music. But it's great if you can bring a friend. It's really a lot better. You know, and a lot of people aren't a lot of people don't like the idea of going out to an event like that alone. There's people who do it, of course, but I think more often than not, if you're going to go out to a restaurant, you want to bring somebody with you to share the experience with. If you're going to go to a concert, it's better to go with a friend. Yeah. There's a lot of things where it's good if you go, but it's better if you're there with a couple other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is very much about the community, and it's really a shared experience. I mean, it's kind of, I don't know if you've ever had, you know, watching a movie at home versus watching the same movie in the movie theater. Like it's,
yeah.
Especially if it's a horror movie or a comedy, you know, there's a part of the fun is the other people that you're sharing it with.
Absolutely. And mm-hmm. so this whole orchestra thing, like, that's really no different, but a mistake that I see a lot is people try to present it as if it's not similar in some way, that it's somehow above that, or
yeah,
a lot of people they look down on promoting something, or but I think when you're promoting something correctly, it doesn't come off as being like braggadocious and like, look at me. When it's done correctly, it's about creating that shared experience that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, then people need to know about your thing if they're going to go to it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. But there's like there's the yell into the well kind of way to do it. And then there's the way where you're focused more on connecting with individual.
So was there a moment or a specific concert that you feel like they got the advertising right, that like you've seen that you looked at the program or, you know, the advertising they were doing, you were just like, this is how it should be done?
Mm-hmm. Well, the good news is I see it done wrong a lot, but it's also done right a lot as well. Like you look at what some of the, like I, what was it like? It was a couple of months ago. I watched a New York Phil video on like live streams on I think it was Facebook or YouTube. I think they're a little bit late to the game, but I think that kind of thing is a really great way to start pulling people in. And also like some of these things where you do like meet and greets with musicians and advertise. As that, like that's a great way to do it, because it puts a face on this thing. It's not just this this big event. Trying to think of a couple others generally that were done. I might be, you know, I'm blanking a little bit right now, but I know that it's because, you know, I'm gonna think of something like 15 minutes after we get off the call and be like,
yeah,
oh, it's check this out, you know. It's that kind of thing. But yeah, I think in general, when something's done right, what that looks like is the emphasis is placed on the experience that a person is going to have, or the promised experience someone's going to have at an event,
mm-hmm.
versus just saying, like, you should come, here's the details, end of story. I know personally one event that that worked really, really well was I had a friend who put together a little music festival out in St. Louis, and the whole idea was that it was a food and music festival.
Oh, that's
cool. So he did a brunch where it was basically you'd pay a ticket price, which was kind of steep for the area, right? It wasn't a cheap ticket. Mm-hmm. But the idea is you pay a ticket and you have the chef come in who made kind of an interesting off-kilter sort of menu. And then we came in and paired all these weirdo menu items with equally weird, if not weirder, music.
Yeah.
So this was out. Like some of it was more like on the classical side. Some of it was more, some of it like went a little bit more jazz. It was more improvised, but a lot of this music was like very challenging. It, like before the event, I'm sitting here thinking like people might be throwing tomatoes at this dude. Like I don't know. I was really skeptical at first, but we went and did it, and I think we did two seatings, and people. Like we sold out both, and we had to turn people away, and they were asking like, "When's the next one? This is awesome," because it was we didn't present it as, "Hey, we're playing contemporary music, and you should like it, so you're sophisticated and feel smart." It was, "Hey, we're doing this crazy thing. We're pairing music. We're pairing food. You've never seen anything like it. You gotta see it to believe it." And that was enough to get people in. It was on a Sunday, so people are looking for something to do.
Yeah.
And I think like I said, I was skeptical. I did not think it was going to work, but I just said, well, let's go in and let's just do it. Let's see what happens. I think the reason that it worked is the emphasis was on the experience, not on us telling people how they should feel and when to show up.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I think there was another group. I'm not sure if they're still doing things. I guess this group, I played with them a little bit. They're called 1B1.
Okay.
They're a Norwegian group. I met them because they came to New York, and their regular bass player had some other kind of commitment with an orchestra he plays with, so they needed a sub for a week. So they did a residency at National Sawdust in Brooklyn. So I played with them for most of those concerts. And they did a pretty good job in an orchestral setting of promoting their music in a way that makes it accessible to people. Without doing, like, I see some kind of corny attempts to do it where they're like, "Hey, we're going to do a Lord of the Rings concert," right? Mm-hmm. That stuff I'm not as into. These guys, like, we played, a lot of we played some more challenging stuff, as far as like a listener's perspective, but then we also played some of the hits too. We were playing Shostakovich and Grieg and those kinds of composers. So they're called 1B1, just one, the letter B and the number one.
Okay.
I'm not sure when they're going to be back in New York. Like I said, I know they're based on the west coast of Norway. But yeah, the guy who runs it, his name is Jan Bjoringer, really smart dude. He's a good example of the kind of thinking as to how to pull more people into classical music as opposed to making it this exclusive experience that you have to sort of be initiated into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll put a link to 1B1. I haven't heard of them, but that's something I've been interested a lot in recently is, how to present as come listen to this music because this music is great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Offering something else or, tailoring a program to something. Cause I think that's very important too, but then how do you advertise it? That's the other difficult question.
Also, I mean, I talk and compare this a lot. Like, if I'm trying to sell somebody new to this music and trying to get them interested in coming to a concert, even if it's coming with me, sometimes they're like when I say, "Oh, like I'm gonna go see an orchestra concert or I'm gonna go see a recital," sometimes the first thing somebody's mind jumps to, they're like, "Huh, recital? I saw my cousin do a piano recital, and I had to see like 40 people, like." Bang through something kind of badly and it was too hot and, there was no, it doesn't usually conjure an instant fun experience for a lot of people. A lot of people don't even realize how much orchestral music that they like and are familiar with.
Yeah.
Like I was doing a funk gig. It was like a funk, soul, and R&B gig last night on electric bass. And, we're on the break. We're talking to people, and they're asking me what else I do. So I tell them, and these people weren't as familiar with that world. But then I started humming a couple pieces. I was like, "Do you know this one?" And they're like, "Yeah." Do you know this one? Yeah. You ever see Space Odyssey? You know that piece? Dun, 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 nah, nah, right? I was like, yeah. That's like a big deal piece. That's not Space Odyssey music. but everybody knows it, right? And they're like, wait, there's like another however long it is. It's like, there's another half an hour of that? Really? Yeah, really. Yeah. I think when you compare it to like, I compare it to movies because that's something people are pretty familiar with and comfortable going to see. Mm-hmm. If you just told somebody the name of a movie they've never heard of, and if you told them that it's going to be an hour and a half long or 2 hours long in a dark room, that's not really a convincing way to get them to go see a movie, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I see what you're getting at.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And even like the reality of watching movies, like, hey, sometimes you're going to be on the edge of your seat. Sometimes you're going to be bored and wondering like, oh, hey, this chair is kind of hurting my ass. I want to leave. there's going to be some highs and lows to the experience, but you know that going in. So you're okay mm-hmm. with it. Right. And I people talk constantly about how, humans are more distracted, like with the phone, they're always texting, blah, blah, blah. Right. A lot of people will still sit down and they're content to sit there for 2 hours and watch a movie, right? Mm-hmm. They're okay with that. They still have the attention span to sit there and pay attention to something for a while. And they're still okay with the idea that sometimes they're going to be really into it. Sometimes they're not. You know, half the fun of the movie is when you get out, you talk about it with whoever you were there with. Yep. Or even if you were alone, you talk to other people. And you're like, oh, hey, did you see this one? Yeah, I saw that one. What'd you think? You know, and you go back and forth about it. It's that shared experience thing.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going back to pitching somebody on coming to a concert for the first time from a composer they've never heard of music that they don't know, right, in a place they've never been to that has like all kind of these odd rituals that they don't know anything about, I compare it to that. I'm like, listen.
Yeah.
You're going to be there a while, you know, you're not going to be completely thrilled. It's hard to pay attention completely for an hour or 2 hour concert. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's coming from a musician who does this stuff, right?
Yeah.
Just being completely honest, there's some moments where I'm in a concert and I'm like, I'm a little bored at this part. This is my favorite thing. But then you get to this part and you're like, whoa, amazing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Me too. Some inherent me too. And lows to the experience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the analogy of just giving them a title of the movie or just saying a movie is good because a lot of, especially, you know, the audiences that aren't going to concerts regularly, they really have no frame of reference. So how can we, make that transition easier for them or more welcoming? That's a good point. So we're almost out of time.
Sure.
But since we have musicians that are not conductors on the podcast so rarely, would you, from a musician's point, I don't know if you have any general conductor comments from people that you've worked with recently. I'm just curious and if we could cut this out if we like, but I was just curious if you had any quick little things good or bad that you've seen that you've worked with conductor wise.
Yeah, as far as conductors, like things that I like and things that I, you know, that tick me off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. That, oh man, that's,
and that may be a longer discussion. I had wanted to ask that earlier, but.
Oh, okay. So I'll try to keep it brief. First of all, musicians, you know, we talk about this a lot, I don't like to talk too much smack about people because, you know, it's just not a good thing to do, for a bunch of reasons, but sometimes it happens. Sometimes people bring it up to me and they'll say like, oh, this idiot, you see what he's doing, blah, blah, blah. Right. So, I mean, that's just something first to be aware of if you're a conductor, is that what you do will be picked apart and discussed. That's, and a lot of people, I don't think that they maybe don't think about it. But again, it comes back to who they're serving. Like the conductor that ticks everybody off is the one who comes in, they get in front of the orchestra and they say, "Hey guys, you're like, hang on to your hats. I'm coming for you." Right. Coming from that angle of, "Hey, I'm the one with the answers. I'm going to impose them on you." That's not what we want. Right. You want to come at it with the, I think, a healthy mindset is how do I, as a conductor, get the best possible result out of these people? Because they know all kinds of things that I maybe don't know. You're dealing with a big group of people who are going to be in a variety of emotional states at any given time, right? I think that's a big one. People, they all have lives. They have all kinds of different things going on. There's going to be some people who are pumped to be there. They're like, yeah, let's do this. And then there's going to be some people who are, you know, maybe they're not, or maybe they're, you know, they have problems or something that they're trying to put aside, or maybe they just didn't sleep that well last night and they're kind of grumpy, right? So you're dealing with a big group of very different people, right, that are all over the place in terms of where their head is at. At least, once you get playing, then everybody lines up if you're dealing with, you know, pros. But before that, to get that to happen, it's pretty scattered, I think. And you need to get them all on the same page, right? So some of the things that I don't want to get too much into specific stuff because we'll sort of be there all day long. But I think as a conductor, the biggest thing you can do to prevent stuff from happening is to just talk to the musicians and ask for honest feedback, and you need to open up sort of a you need to let them know that you're on their side, right? So when you talk to them, if you're asking for critique, they're going to be really afraid to say anything negative, right? I think you need to be really clear with them and say, like, "Hey, if there's, you know, I'm looking for feedback, and how did that feel for you? Like, how were those tempos?" You need to create a space where they feel okay giving you an honest critique, even if it isn't super pretty. I think that's, and like, just the fact that you're asking is already a big step that a lot of conductors don't do. They just get up there, they do their thing, and then they want to bounce and just, you know, kind of hang out. That's what I see a lot. If you're a younger, like, you just need to treat it as if, you know, what's the way to put it? Like, I think it's healthier when a conductor comes in thinking of themselves more as a special type of principal player, as opposed to like the king or queen.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's like if I'm in front of a bass section and I know that everybody in the section is really good, I don't have to pull anybody along, right? And I know that they're committed. What am I going to have to do to make them happy, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to do stuff where I'm like making them do weird bowings. Like if I change a bowing, I'll say like, "Hey guys, what do you think?" Or if somebody has a suggestion, I listen to it and consider it. And then sometimes you got to make a decision and you say, "Hey, that's a great idea. Let's do it." Or, "No, let's not do that. I'll tell you why later." Like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But the point is that I'm listening. I don't talk. Oh, this is a big one. Don't talk too much. Dear God. I've sat there in orchestras with just fun, like looking at a stopwatch on my phone saying like, talking. If we're having a 2-hour rehearsal and 45 minutes of it is some dude or some woman talking to me about how they think things should be, like, don't talk, show me. That's what you should do.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I'm not like, I would rather have an hour and a half rehearsal and 15 minutes of talking rather than a 2-hour rehearsal with 45. So that's just something that ubiquitously makes people cranky. But again, if I'm a principal player, my section they don't want to hear me just talk. Like, show. That's better, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And consider how they feel. I think approaching it as I'm part of this group, like, as opposed to I'm in front of this group. It's a big difference in the mindset that you come at it with, I think.
Yeah, that's a very different angle, and one I had not heard before. I like the way you described it as being a principal player, especially, right?
Uh-huh.
I think that's a good way to think about it. Will, do you have any parting words? I'm gonna have to leave in a minute.
Oh yeah. So before I leave, like I said, I know the book, you can get it on Amazon right now, or you can get it on my website, which I'm sure you'll link to.
Of course.
I think on my website, it's only the digital versions. It's an ebook or an audio book, narrated by yours truly. then on Amazon, you can get it in whatever format you want. They have it on Kindle, you know, paperback, all that stuff. So either of those two places. I'm trying to think what else. You know, I'm on Twitter a little bit. I don't check that a ton. If you want to get in touch with me, the best place to do it is just go to the contact form on my website. That form just goes straight to my inbox. So you can email me there. You know, if you want to do the social media thing, like I said, I'm on Facebook and Twitter a little bit. You know, Instagram is probably the better one that I check a little bit more often.
Mm-hmm.
My handle there is @EmilioThink. So if you want to check that out, that's the place to do it. I'm not like on a social media promotion thing right now. So really, if you want to get in touch with me, the best thing is just go on my website, EmilioGarino.com, go to the contact form, shoot me an email through there.
Mm-hmm. Alrighty. Yeah. We'll include all those links. I've got the book on Kindle, but I've been wanting to get a hardcover copy because I like to mark my books up and put sticky notes in.
Oh, send me an email. I can just send you one.
All right, sounds good.
You just send me your address. I could drop one in the mail for you. I'd be happy to do that.
Oh, cool. That would be awesome.
And again, I appreciate the invitation. Thanks for having me. It's the least I could do.
Yeah. Well. Thanks so much. And we covered a lot of good stuff that I hadn't expected to cover. So I'm glad we were able to talk with you this morning.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Podium Time. You can find show notes for this episode and all of our other episodes at podiumtimepod.wordpress.com. Be sure to join our mailing list there or on our Facebook page at facebook.com/podiumtimepod. Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony was performed by the Czech National Symphony Orchestra, and Beethoven's Egmont Overture was performed by Stefano Ligorati.